with that, we're going to move into a very brief session of questions, combining the questions that we had set up for our panel session as well as ones we've received from the audience. And as I mentioned, we'll provide written responses to any that we can't get to now. And so with that, I will turn it over to Dana Spindler from ICF to facilitate the discussion. Thank you, Dana.
Okay. Thanks, Emma, and thanks to all the speakers for your presentations. This first question is for Lynn. And the question is, are there any case studies of small municipalities or water systems that can implement these types of water projects that you talked about today?
I'm happy to say that at this point in time, there are a lot of them. There have been a lot of pioneering cities of all sizes out there. A couple of the smallest city that comes to my mind is Edmundston, Maryland. It's a relatively poor town of about 1,300 people, I think, and they've done a really impressive Green Streets initiative. And one of the neatest things about what they did was that they open sourced all the plans for the green infrastructure that they put in so that other municipalities could kind of cut and paste what they had done rather than having to pay for all the development, the concept development costs. And so those plans, as I understand it, are available online. I'd say that there are lots of examples of cities of all sizes, and perhaps the best resource out there is the American Society of Landscape Architects. If you put in ASLA and stormwater or stormwater case studies into a search engine, I think you'll pretty quickly land on, they have this amazing compendium of case studies, and you can search it by state, and it's a really nice resource for anyone looking for examples that they can take to their city council or their planners, say, hey, I want something like this, and it shows how they paid for it and everything. So,
great. Thank you, Lynn. This next question is for Gino, and we've spent some time discussing how to take a multi-sectoral or integrated approach to climate adaptation. What information and resources do public health decision makers need from partners to integrate adaptation? And conversely, what resources do public health officials have to contribute to the process?
Yeah, thanks for the question. I mean, as far as information goes from a public health perspective, there are a few things that would be useful. Information on climate projections and any assistance to interpret this would be very useful and very helpful to public health agencies. And also information or data that provides more insight into vulnerability. So things like any demographic data, physical features, spatial features, or even social features. New data sets that can overlay that type of information that would enable a health department to work out who is at risk, how they're at risk, and the way the environment is either protective or actually adds to the risk factor. So that's all really helpful information. So if you have access to that kind of data, you may find that a health department can actually use that, or you may be able to work with a health department to actually look at vulnerability. And I guess the other major need is that of inclusion, and that, so that a health department is included early on in the scoping of a policy, a project, or a program that may be taking place in another sector or in another agency. So, by including public health folks, it can help to avoid any adverse or unintended harmful consequences, or it can be an opportunity to highlight how to gain new or really maximize already thought-out co-benefits. So things like, designing transportation, locating services, city planning, enhancing infrastructures. A good example might be, if you're actually trying to increase green space or looking into parks and that sort of thing, there's a lot of co-benefits to that, but then your choice in trees may also add to, allergies, the allergy loading, and health public health people might be able to help with that, understanding allergies and just other repercussions, whereas, they can also be a champion and assist you by kind of championing the fact that extra green space will be better for air quality, will also provide environments where people can get some exercise, really good for kind of social cohesion and social connection. So there are a number of ways that it may be helpful to include public health. But, it's really got to be done early so that a health department can kind of help with any tweaking of a design or an approach. And, you know, they have tools of doing that, like through a health impact assessment. But, yeah, I think, yeah, that probably answers the question. I don't know if anyone else wants to add anything.
I think that we just have a few more minutes left, and I want to make sure that I get a question for all the speakers today. So thank you, Gino. I think our next question is for Scott, and we've spent some time talking about how to fund climate adaptation using integrated decision-making in health, water, and hazards planning. Looking beyond these sectors, where do you see opportunities for adaptation action? Do you have any recommendations, best practices, or lessons learned regarding how to identify opportunities for collaboration or integration?
Thanks. Well, for the first part of the question, I think besides health, water, and hazard challenges, I think we've covered a few, including transportation planning, ecosystem services planning, and land use planning, which could include building codes. And really, I think you can integrate adaptation in any sort of planning efforts, especially ecosystem services, I think, will be emerging in the upcoming years and play a vital role in the adaptation efforts. The second part of the question, do I have any recommendations or best practices or lessons learned? You know, I think for the people who, in the cities especially, who haven't really started planning yet for adaptation, I think there's some good ways to get caught up to speed. And one is attending events like this webinar that you can really get a good rounded perspective of where the country and neighboring cities are on this effort. Another is participating in a working group. And I think having a collaborative working group that uses members outside of whatever organization you're working with is also a really good way to get caught up to speed and learn what the best practices are for that area. There's conferences that I've been to that have been really good, and the National Adaptation Forum in Denver, ran by EcoAdapt, was a really great way. It had about 500 people there, all sorts of officials, federal, state, local, tribal, that really were interested in this area and could share practices, and there are a couple working groups that emerged from that. There's a couple other organizations, associations that I'd like to mention: the Association for Climate Change Officers and the American Society of Adaptation Professionals are both ways that you can become members and really share in their network and practices to get some lessons learned and get caught up to speed. Thanks.
Thank you, Scott. So one more question that I hope we can get in. I know that we're a minute or two over, but this question is for Alessandra. And regarding rebuilding homes in areas that are extremely vulnerable to hurricane or flooding damage or have already been impacted by hurricanes or flooding, do you have any suggestions about how to deal with government or politicians' resistance to saying no to rebuilding in such vulnerable areas?
That really is a challenge that arises very often, because when there's been an impact, there's tremendous pressure from the public and sometimes from all levels of government as well to really rebuild very quickly and to put things back the way they were. And there's something about that post-disaster environment that makes everybody remember what used to be very, very fondly, and everybody sort of idealizes what used to be normal. And that makes it very difficult for a politician or a city official or anyone to say, hey, let's stop and think, let's do this differently. Maybe when we rebuild, the community is going to look a little different. Maybe there are some places where we can't rebuild or where rebuilding safely is going to be so challenging that perhaps there are alternatives. And that varies from communities to communities. And what I would say is that some things that can help with that are certainly pre-planning. The more that conversation has happened ahead of time, I talked about pre-disaster recovery planning, it can help to speed things up. It can help to have buy-in ahead of time for the ways in which the community can become stronger and avoid experiencing the event again. And as much as people want things to go back to the way they used to be, they also don't want to go through this again. And the benefits of higher standards, such as building with elevation or with freeboard, not just in terms of avoiding the event, but also in terms of cost savings, especially now with bigger waters, the Flood Reform Act, can also be a powerful tool and a way for politicians and community officials to say, you know, we're not trying to make your life harder. We're actually trying to help you be safer. We are trying to help reduce your flood insurance costs with freeboard. And NHMA has some resources for that. If you go to our website, www.nhma.info/Sandy, you'll find a 9 steps to recovery document with some examples from an actual community and a 9-step process that can help with this, and has some information on communities that have successfully navigated the process. And you'll also find some information at on building higher, on incorporating freeboard. And there's no easy answer to this, but there are some resources that can perhaps help a bit.
Thank you, Alessandra. I'm going to pass it over to Emma to wrap us up. Thank you all for presenting and your answers to the questions.
And thank you to everyone on the line for sticking on for just a few extra minutes with us. I know we're past the time that we have allotted. Any questions that we didn't get to, we will certainly provide responses to those online. And there is also a copy of Paul's presentation that's available so folks can see the content from his case study on what California is doing with adaptation and public health. So thank you again to all of our speakers for sharing their time and expertise. Hopefully this has provided folks on the line with a lot of great ideas and examples about how to form partnerships across different sectors and activities to leverage the funding and resources that are out there, since, as we all know, adaptation is not necessarily something that's being funded explicitly, although it is getting more attention in the light of various storms and droughts, and budgets are certainly tight across the board. So thank you again for your participation. The files for this webcast, as well as the ones that we had focusing on getting buy-in and overcoming uncertainty, will all be on our website, and I certainly encourage folks to check those out. So thanks again, and please tune into our newsletter. You can sign up for that at our website to hear announcements about other upcoming webcasts. So thanks again, and join us again soon. Thank you.
This concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect. Presenters, please stay on the line.